everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two sponsors here to mention at the top of the show. Environments for Humans are doing an online summit. They're calling the Web Standards Sherpa Summit. And it's really interesting. It's an online summit to benefit the Web Standards Sherpa project, which is going offline, and they're going to get some money up so that they can kind of save the site and make sure that all that content is like kind of archived properly. So we'll tell you more about that later in the show. And another app called Speed Curve at speedcurve.com, which is a website all about front-end web performance and monitoring it and setting performance budgets and alerts. And you know, it's a really nice interface for kind of keeping on track of your front-end web performance. Both these things are totally awesome, and I'm glad they're sponsors. We're going to tell you about them later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off.
That's not even what it is.
You're listening to Shop Talk.
You're listening to Shop Talk Show.
It's hard to force it, Dave.
It's an intellectual podcast for intellectuals. I'm Dave Rupert.
And I'm Chris Coyer. Thanks for joining us. And we have with us today a very special guest, Mr. Alex Russell. Hey, Alex, thanks for joining us.
Oh, hi. How's it going?
Good. Yay. So Alex is from many different teams over at the Goog. So Chrome team, Blink team, web platform team, are all those the same team? Are they different teams? Or maybe you want to just kind of tell us about your work and role over there at Google?
Yeah, so I think you described them in sort of like, if it's a turducken, you described them in descending order of delicious meat. The Chrome team is quite large. The Blink team is somewhat smaller, and the web platform team inside the Blink team is a bit smaller still. So I guess you asked me, what do I do? Oh, God.
Sorry. Is there a way for us to break it up a little better?
Or? Yeah, sure. So I'm responsible now these days for a good chunk of what goes wrong with Chrome's standards engagement, which means specifically interactions between the Chrome team and other browser vendors and framework authors and TC39 and the W3C and all the people who show up there to try to make the world better, because I think that's everyone's goal if you spend any time working on a browser or anywhere near standards. So lots of people have different ideas about how to do that, and a part of my job is to try to figure out how to make that go better. Specifically on the Chrome team, I'm with Mike So, helping to lead a project that you may have seen some of the results of today. This could not be a more fortuitously timed podcast that we planned months in advance. Ha, ha, ha. yeah, Chrome releases are not that exact. We today just sent Chrome 42 to the beta channel for Android specifically, which is exciting because it means that notifications and push messaging are coming to the web for Chrome users in 42. Across all OSs, and a prompted add to home screen button, where if you meet specific criteria with your web app, we'll ask users if they want to keep it, very much like an install button. But unlike the sort of add bookmark to home screen thing that we've had in the past, this one actually shows up in your face if you visit a site often enough and it meets the criteria that we've set, which we hope will keep it from being spammy. And the goal here is for you to be able to like make a good website. And if you make a great website and users engage with it, we'll ask them if they want to have a long-term relationship. Do you want to go steady with this app? is the idea. And, you know.
I think we should probably spend time on each one of these three things that you've mentioned so far, just for fun. So this one
I also work on service workers and a lot of other things.
Yeah, well, they're on my list, Alex. I promise we'll talk about those things. But you're proud of this current release right now, particularly because you're kind of the all standards engagement. You're kind of a lead on this particular release, right?
Well, so there's a huge amount of work that's gone into this from a big team. Specifically, you might know from Standards or JavaScript Land, Peter Beverloo and Michael Van Oerkerk and Monir mm-hmm. Lemuri out of the Chrome team for Android out of London have done a huge amount of this work. There's a cast of people who just really don't have any web or standards or, you know, web developer presence right now.
Yeah.
Who've done a ton of work on this stuff, specifically
the Dark Matter developers.
Yeah, Sydney and Mountain View and San Francisco who've been churning at this stuff for months and months. But basically the way these things work is you get a bunch of people into a physical room once you've figured out what a problem is, and you try to solve it. You try to come up with good ideas, and then those ideas get tested and change radically over the course of many months. And then eventually, you know, at some unknown time in the future, you eventually get to launch it.
Sounds like software development.
Yes, but for most software development, you're not gated on the opinions of people
smaller.
Who aren't on your team, right? Like, you don't just get to convince yourself or other people who work at Google in this case. You get to convince people across a bunch of different interlocking standards working groups about both the value and the veracity of your solution. And then you have to go argue with them about the details that you have now convinced yourself about. And that can be a particularly unbounded set of people. You know, anybody who chooses to show up to a standards activity basically gets to have a say about whether or not it's going well. You know, mm-hmm. that's a particularly mm-hmm. treacherous moment for a new idea working its way out. But it's good. I mean, it's not as good as actually having real users using it, but it's certainly better to have more eyes on a thing than fewer.
Yeah, yeah. So there's one particular thing. We'll do the add to home, as that's kind of the moniker it has, right? So this is a new thing that's part of Chrome 42 that shipped on Android specifically today to beta. So if I go to daveruppert.com enough times, and this is presumably some secret algorithm, which even though it's open source, it's still secret somehow.
It's not secret. I'm happy to tell you all about it.
Okay.
Just awesome. You, though. None of the listeners.
Yeah, no one's listening. Zero people down. Well, two people download this.
Okay.
It's my mom and Chris's Dallas.
They go 10 times in a month or something like that. They get a little pop-up that's like, would you like to add DaveRuppert.com to the home screen? And what's particularly cool about that is not just increased engagement, but it gives the web a little more presence. Isn't that one of the big things that the web has to win? It has to test a battle. It's like a battleground for the web, right? A presence on the home screen.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of think of it this way. The web is pretty good in a fair fight, right? The web is a system where you can build something and deploy it with zero friction. You don't have to go ask users to go install something. It's super straightforward. You can click on a link, and then you're there at the thing. No other system in the world has delivered something quite this good, quite this ubiquitously, right? So we've tried a bunch of times to build other systems that kind of have much of the same guts. You know, I've said before that if you look at systems like Palm applications or Firefox OS applications or Chrome apps or Windows 8 applications or Adobe Air applications or Cordova apps, I could keep going, by the way. I have a very long list of these. But if you look at all these systems, what they do is they basically start with the premise that what everybody loves about the web is writing HTML, JavaScript, and CSS, and not the ability to get to that thing without any friction. And I think that actually is completely backwards. I think everybody loves getting to things that are awesome with zero friction and believing that they're safe and not having to worry about it. And nobody likes writing HTML, JavaScript, and CSS. I'd like to fix those things too, but I don't think that putting HTML, JavaScript, and CSS in a different format or a different package actually solves anything. As a developer, what I want to do is just make a website, make a good website, and if it's awesome, I would like for it to, you know, be first class on mm-hmm. my OSs. So the thing that we launched, or we are going to launch to stable soon, but is in beta channel for Android now, is going to come to desktop as well. I don't know that's going to be a shock to anyone. Chrome apps are already there. But we're going to make that possible on the desktop at some point in the future. I can't say when, but soon. And it'll work exactly the same way. You build a website. It's served over TLS. It's got a service worker. It's got some responsive breakpoints. And it's got a manifest. It points to a manifest with a series of high-quality icons, you know, better than 144 by 144, or at least that, a name, a description. And as long as it's got that stuff, we'll ask users if you want to do it, if they want to keep that application. If they visit it right now, the heuristic is a couple of times in a couple of weeks. But, you know, we're going to play with that aspect, the engagement heuristic, because, you know, one of the things that we frequently get wrong in building web platform features is that we either give them API far too early, or we don't give ourselves the ability to iterate on those features. And so we get it wrong a lot, but we don't have any ability to take it back later. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to change some of those heuristics to try to improve.
Yeah, this one doesn't seem particularly dangerous to change, right? It's just a little.
Yeah, we did play a lot with the notion of having an API that developers could call to try to ask for that prompt. But I, as a user, I don't want that.
Every single developer will just use it then, you know, of course.
Well, I mean, don't we already have that? Don't we already have like every website on a mobile device prompting you with a slam door in your face to please install their native app, even though, you know, their native app is frequently a poor version of their web app. You know, I can't tell you the number of times, especially
movietickets.com.
Dang.
That was a sick burn on native apps. That's
well, good. No. I just sort of is like, especially as an Android user, I experienced this this tragedy where they've made a kick-ass iOS app and they made a great web thing, and then they keep asking me to install their Android app, and it's got like 2/3 of the features that I really want, and then maybe one extra feature, which is badass, which is enabled by good hardware. But it doesn't do, like, I can't change my profile photo from the app. What? You know, that sort of thing happens a lot.
I was going to say, this is probably a really awesome API if other browsers pick it up. Like, I imagine Windows Phone, which their app store is notoriously thin. Like, they probably want to pick up an API like this too, right? Is this something you're standardizing, or is this kind of a Chrome-only thing right now?
That's a great question. So, we have no idea what everyone else is going to do, which is the traditional, by the way, this is the traditional fog of war that all standards are developed in. Nobody knows what anyone else is going to do, in part because you don't know what you yourself are going to do in the near future.
But you've kind of put your cards on the table. You're if it's Texas Hold'em, you're kind of like, here.
We're willing to go first in the hopes that it will make it easier for other people to choose to do the same thing. But you asked about standards. And so in this is an area where we are leaning on the W3C manifest format and service workers and you know, stuff that's in CSS already. So there's nothing new here, right? This is all just us providing better UI about things that you could already add to your website. Like I said earlier, we just want you to build a kick-ass website, and then we want to give you credit for it.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So related to all this is the two other things, which you mentioned were notifications and push notifications, them being different kind of things. I think of that as like there's like the kind of like the lame-ish ones on desktop where like if you're on that website, it can give you this little thing that pops up outside your browser window, and you're like, yeah, but only if I'm there. And then push, which are the good ones, which means like I've opted into a please tell me if my flight is late kind of thing, right? Like, even if I'm not on that website.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that you're going to get notifications that aren't delivered to you when the site isn't running is pretty comical, right? I mean, you know, I'm already looking at it.
Right. I mean, it's only maybe useful if it's like, I don't know, like Gmail or something that you probably have as an open tab but isn't your focused tab usually. Like, maybe, but pretty lame, you know?
Yeah, maybe. And the real problem there is that, especially on low-end devices, you know, Chrome specifically, thanks to the Android process model, if it's taking a lot of memory, you know, we might just kill it, right, in the background, right? We might just, you know, recycle processes like we do on Chrome OS and for Android. So, you know, the idea that just because you had a tab open, you were going to get the notification doesn't really even work there. So anyhow, let's talk about the good stuff. So what we're doing is not that. we've used service workers as a place where, because they're event driven, you can wake up just the service worker, send it the push message that the server wanted to deliver, and then your code inside that service worker can pop up a notification. We've got a permission that you can request about this, and when you request it, the user says yes to push notifications. We say, cool
story. Just like geolocation and other stuff like that, it's just opt-in.
Very much like that. Yes. Just exactly like that. The APIs are, on the standards track. It's just the same stuff that you're kind of used to. Matt Gaunt has a great article about using this set of things together today.
Okay.
But the way
one follow up is that is it do I have to okay every service worker, or is it a particular APIs that maybe we should explain what service workers are at all, because I think we jumped in a little deep. Yeah.
So service workers are the way to think about them is they're primary use is as a programmable proxy in the browser. You can go to a website and it can install one. It doesn't have to ask for anything, by the way. Service workers just can sort of show up the way app caches kind of just show up. Mm-hmm. You go to a website and then it says, hey, I want to work offline. I'm going to install a service worker for myself. And then if you go back to it sometime later, when you send a network request for a top-level navigation, like you click in on a link or you type something into the URL bar and the URL matches the registration that was made earlier, that script will get started and an event will get sent to it. In this case, a fetch event. And so your script can handle that fetch event and do whatever it wants. It also has access to a new cache API, which is, I think, pretty cool because it lets you actually cache real HTTP requests and responses. And so you can sort of take something off the wire from a fetch, put it into the cache, and then sometime later, if you get a fetch event that's asking for some content, you can say, hey, do I have this in the cache? If so, I can just hand it back to you. But additionally, you can, with a service worker, just create a response out of whole cloth. You could do what quote-unquote server-side templating on a client without changing anything about the way you make requests from the document. So it's like a programmable proxy in the browser. But the important part about it for the purposes of push and notifications is that it's event-driven. So the way service workers work is that they only live as long as the events that have asked them to do some work for them. So in that fetch case, let's say I go to example.com and it's got a picture of a cat GIF and cool. You keep it up as a tab, but you don't really do anything with it. The cat GIF is just sitting there. We can kill the service worker, right? We don't have to keep it running. We don't have to keep it taking up memory because we can just start it back up the next time that we send a fetch event to it or some other sort of event to it, like a post message event or an on message from a post message, so that we don't have to keep using resources in the background. But what that means is that we can start it up in exactly the same way even when that tab isn't running, when there's nothing sort of already there to keep it available. So from the push perspective, that means that you can handle a push event from the browser. Go, oh, okay, cool, which website is this for? It's for example.com. I'll start a service worker, send it an on-push event, and then it'll be able to be woken up, even if there aren't any tabs for it, which is how we get to the place where we can do exactly what it is you were talking about, the background push thing. So if you've granted the notification, the push notification permission, from there, now we've added the notification API to the service worker context, so you can just say new notification, and it'll show up.
Yep. This is pretty cool. So this is low level stuff, people, and for the moment, mobile, right? There's no desktop.
Version pushing notifications are coming to desktop.
Oh, cool. Yeah, but I mean, they kind of make more sense on mobile anyway. But not that they're not useful on desktop. But we generally think of push notifications as a mobile-ish thing.
I mean, I guess they probably will be more useful for mobile, but I don't know. I mean, we'll see. We'll see what people do with it. I think the big challenge for web apps so far has been re-engagement. It's easier on desktop when people can just sort of type into a desktop search box and find the thing they were looking for. I'm not sure how that will play out, but we're making it available everywhere because we don't know what people will want to do.
Yeah, right. True. And you just don't know because it's in it, especially because it's so new. But, you know, I'm always imagining, I think I've even seen some startups that are kind of trying to be middlemen for push notifications in a way like, oh, is this stuff too complicated for you? Don't worry. We'll kind of help you out with it. And, you know, to the, because of, I think publishers will be interested in it. I think it'll be like, you know, did you miss this post on BuzzFeed? Don't worry because we can bug you even when the BuzzFeed tab is closed. You know, then I'll be opt-in.
Is that, yeah. The great news here is that it's all opt-in. You don't make that choice by just visiting BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed would have to ask your permission to do that.
Yeah, and you might want it because it might be cool. Who knows what people want? So we don't know.
Yeah, and right? If they suck, we're actually putting. You may have seen if you look at the blog post, you'll see that there's a very prominent site settings button in each of these things where if you don't want it, you can just go turn it off.
Yeah. Cool. That's good. I didn't even think of that, but it's kind of like how you like, for example, right now, let's say I granted, you know, geolocational okayness to pizzahut.com because I was like, I don't feel like typing in my address or whatever, however that works. How do I take it away? I don't know. There's probably a way, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, we could set up like Shop Talk, for example, to send a push notification to people when we're broadcasting, like when our show goes live.
Oh, yeah, that like would
that's
be awesome.
A feature we could do, right?
Oh, I totally want to do that.
Hey-o. Wow.
I know. It's like we're real app developers.
What is going on? Does that make my podcast website, a podcast web app? Is that what happens?
You tell me. I have no idea what the difference between those words is anymore.
Yeah.
When you can be on the home screen, when you can send notifications, when you can run full screen once you're launched from a tap on the home screen, what's the difference?
Yeah, and you can control the color of the top bar too.
Yeah.
Well, that's the, like, whenever people go web versus native and whatever, they do a PowerPoint about it. They're like, big points are like, web is not installable. It is, but it's kind of weird and janky, but you guys seem to have fixed it now.
So there are caveats, by the way. There are definitely integration issues so far, and we're looking at ways of improving that in the future. But you know, you'll note that when you add it to the home screen, it doesn't show up in your all applications list on Android today.
Okay.
We would like to fix that in the future. It's sort of difficult technically at the moment, but we are hopeful that there is some path forward in the future. But we don't know. But yeah, so there is a little bit of an uncanny valley, and we'll see what users like and don't like. Right.
Mm-hmm. What about persistent login? Like, you know, I never have to log into Facebook when I open the native app, but I probably would if I just used the web version. Or is that solved somehow?
So this cuts both ways, right? One of the things that people really hate when they upsell you to a native app off of their website is that you are frequently logged in on the website. You are already you there, and then you have forgotten that you started using Facebook on the web and then they had an app and you installed the app and then you had to figure out your Facebook login all over again to get it logged in again on the app. You did do that. I guarantee it.
Right.
They didn't have any access to the cookie jar and so they weren't able to take your identity and take it with you when you installed the app. So that sucks from a user experience perspective. So one of the things we can do better about there is that these shortcut apps are using the same cookie jar on Chrome anyway. And that means that you are you. If you were you on the website before, you are you when you tap that icon now. But that also means that you're subject to the same sort of eviction stuff. Like you clear your caches and, well, now your apps have amnesia. Yeah. So we're looking at a couple of things here. There's a proposal for something called storage durability, which would basically let an app ask for the permission to not have their stuff thrown out just sort of as you're browsing around. That is to say, like, you know, if we find ourselves under storage pressure as a browser and we would evict some stuff otherwise, maybe we wouldn't evict your stuff. Obviously, if users choose to clear stuff, we're definitely going to continue to allow that. I don't think that it's a reasonable thing for us to decide that, you know, somehow some application is better than all y'all. So we're going to leave users in control of that, at least in Chrome. But yeah, so we're looking at that. But the other side of it is that you know, native apps can install things like identity providers, and those can be available across the system. We don't have a way to do that yet. That's an API that I think we would love to try to figure out how to do. You know, what would it mean to do tighter integration of OAuth and, you know, native system stuff? I don't know. I would like to figure it out.
Cool. Let me do a sponsor really quick. We have the Environments for Humans, a longtime sponsor of Shop Talk Show. As you know, they do these online summits. They're doing another one coming up here. And we'll, you know, put the full URL on the thing. I'm not sure if they've made a short URL for it, but it's environmentsforhumans.com/2015/web Sherpa Summit with dashes in between the things. And we'll put a link to it in the thing. But the idea is there's this website called the Web Standards Sherpa, literally webstandardssherpa.com. That's been around for a long time. There's lots of good content in there from a variety of authors, and they have to take it offline there or put it into like kind of archive mode, right? Like the its run is over. It costs some money to do that. You should probably buy a server and put it up there and change the design and explain what you're going to do and just make sure that it lives on the web. You know, they're trying to do the responsible thing, not just take it offline and wreck the URLs and, you know, that kind of thing. They're trying to kind of gracefully end its life. And so Environments for Humans are going to throw a summit with a bunch of the authors from the Web Standards Sherpa project are going to go give a talk and talk about stuff and do one of their online conferences. And the proceeds for that conference are, you know, and I wouldn't think of it as like a charity conference, even though it happens to have that vibe. You can still like go and like learn a bunch of stuff about the web from really smart people. So that's pretty cool. And at the same time, kind of benefit the longevity of the Web Standards Sherpa project. So go to that summit. It should be pretty cool. A bunch of people you'll recognize from the show. You know, Aaron Gustafson is kind of the Web Standards Sherpa dude, the lead of that kind of project. But Laura Kalbag, yeah, who's been on the show, Derek Featherstone, Dan Maul, Emily Lewis, all kinds of great people. Go to the show. You're going to love it. Let's do some more talking about all this stuff, shall we? We talked about service workers, low-level stuff. We talked about the new stuff in Chrome pushing. We didn't talk a bunch about web components yet, though. And what was your what's your kind of role in all that, Alex?
Instigator, I'm afraid. Dmitry Glazkov gleefully blames me. I think that's it's overstating my role, but... I definitely was there at the beginning when Dmitry and I and Eric Harvidson and a bunch of other people on the Chrome team sort of, you know, we had done Chrome Frame, which was a plugin to try to bring the trailing edge of the web ecosystem back up towards the front of the pack. And then we started asking ourselves the question, okay, let's say that you could build with tip of tree WebKit. Like, let's say you could just build with the best of what we had today, and you didn't have to deal with legacy stuff, what would our tools and frameworks look like? What would still be wrong? And so we started a project internally at Google called the Parkour Project, wherein our logo, I guess, was the offices parkour segment, where there's a bunch of middle-aged men pretending to be funny. You should go find it someplace because it will explain everything about us. But the overall goal was to try to figure out what sucked about web development circa, you know, middle of 2010, even if you had the very best tools available. And so out of that, we you know, Tab Atkins played a big part, and just tons of people helped. And we wound up running an effort for about a year till 2011, when we sort of took the wraps off at I/O that year.
Wow, and, this is not particularly. It feels very new, but it's been around a lot of years.
Yeah, I'll dig up the I/O talk because the stuff that you're seeing now with ECMAScript 6 classes, which are also in Chrome 42, and subclassability for DOM elements and other built-ins, as well as scoped CSS and shadow DOM and custom elements and not HTML imports because we hadn't invented that yet. But all that stuff sort of came out of that project. Because we started building it all together, we built a bunch of apps that were trying to push the edge, and we were like, whoa, part of this sucks because, you know, we still have to like build a system to build widgets. And what we really want is for those widgets just to be HTML. And so, you know, we had a series of insights there, and we started an effort along all of these prongs to try to get to some satisfaction, to try to build a better ecosystem for building the kinds of apps that we're building lots of. Because we looked around at the toolkits that Eric and I and Dmitry had worked on, but we also looked at, you know, Flex and XAML and Swing and JSX and JSF and whatever the Java one at the time was. Just all the frameworks that sort of had this world that they evolved to, where they've got a programmatic side, which is sort of how the component actually works itself out at runtime, and this declarative side, which sort of gives you a facade for this stuff, so that you can pass it around to your coworkers and they can just stamp one out and configure it.
So there's plenty really of proof that people wanted this stuff. There's all these frameworks that already exist.
Clojure, XJS, Dojo, Sentia. Mm-hmm. I mean, just like you keep going and going, and everyone's building one or two or five in Google's case. And so, you know, we decided to try to figure out what was common among them and see if we could do better, if we could extend the platform to support them better. And so that led to a series of proposals. And so the proposals that have shipped today in Chrome are a bunch of the extensions to JavaScript, which I'm really happy about, as well as HTML imports, custom elements, Shadow DOM, and the template tag. Object.observe and mutation observers fell out of this work as well. We had a bunch of proposals for scope CSS, CSS variables, and mix-ins, and I think those are still in flight, but they're not shipping anywhere yet.
Cool. It's interesting. I guess I didn't know that whole history, that it's like that it was born out of this, like if we didn't have to worry about the old, you know, like what does web development look like, you know, if we can do whatever we want.
Web development of the future. Yeah.
So that's great.
Web development 2000.
Actually, now it's real. Given, it's a real thing.
The size of the delta between what sort of the leading frameworks could do, what XAML could do, what you could do with a Windows app and the web, it definitely feels still a little bit too much like web development 2000. But I'm grateful that our performance has gotten a lot better at rendering and animations. Oh, I forgot web animations. Yeah, that also came out of this effort. We did a bunch of shit.
But so web components is awesome, but you guys have met a little bit of static, right? Like hasn't WebKit said, no, not going to do it on like HTML imports? Is that right? Or maybe that was Firefox?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of... Because we kind of designed it as a Voltron-style project, where if all the pieces show up, you get this awesome thing, but each of the pieces are individually useful no matter what, you kind of get, like I mentioned earlier, it's always the case that when you go to try to build something that other people have to agree on and implement in their platform, not only do they get a say, but you have to convince them that it's a good idea. And that's often a long process. It took us a long time to decide on many of the specific details of our system. Mm. And one of the ways that we attempted to do better there was both to study the existing world and try to understand what was common about it. But then, you know, by mid-2011, by that I.O. talk where we started asking other people for input and feedback and went to the working groups and started begging for other people to work with us to get it done. From then on, you know, we have been attempting to course correct. And in, I think, 2012, we were very, very lucky to get the Polymer team, who came to us sort of out of Palm, folks who I had the pleasure of working with before on Dojo, and they have been troopers in sort of taking their mandate as use this stuff and tell us what sucks, right? Try to build something awesome and tell us what sucks. And they have done that. They have done an amazing job of like giving us direct feedback about why the system isn't meeting their goals and what they really want and what would be better in terms of building really immersive UIs. And so we have tried to correct our understanding based on that and conversations with other framework authors and try to get data as opposed to speculation about how we should do better. One of the troubling things for me about the way web standards have previously been built has been that guessing has been good enough. And I don't mean that in any pejorative way, because when you don't really know anything, then guessing is all you got. So you might as well guess, right? You got to start somewhere. But it's possible, I think, to do better than that now. Specifically when you can work in close collaboration with framework authors, you can understand maybe if you look at what they do and not what they say, but certainly try to take their feedback to heart. You can try to evolve your system in a way that both meets their expectations and prevents them and you from getting into a situation where they're having to route around you instead of building with you to deliver a good experience. Because one of the things that we see so frequently inside the web platform is that it's often the case that we just haven't exposed a hook for something. Like, the easiest way to think about web components is that there's a parser inside of the browser which takes a token stream, right? Just a chunk of stuff that you sent down as HTML, and we try to turn that into HTML tags and attributes. Okay, so what do? We chop that up, and then we figure out what that tag was. Okay, cool, that is a tag, right? Okay, what's its name? All right, we'll go look at this list of stuff over there, and then we'll figure out which class we should create an instance of, and then we'll go and we'll configure that instance with a bunch of the attribute stuff, and then we'll put it back in the DOM where we found it, right? Does that make sense?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So why can't you put your own names in that list that gets consulted? That's all we're trying to do. We're just trying to break up the monopoly on the parser. We're trying to say, yeah, I should totally be able to put my stuff in the parser. And I should be able to totally make something that's a subclass of HTML element. Why can't I do that? That's bullshit. So then if I can, then I can play. I can be first class. I can be a first class citizen. I think you're starting to see this show up in my work a lot, right? Between wanting to be first class on the home screen and wanting to be first class in the DOM. It's really kind of, you know.
It's honestly how I think of you, Alex. You're like the low-level guy. I want to do what I want to do.
Well, no, I want to play along too. I want to be bought in. I don't want to be a second class citizen. That sucks. I don't want to do that.
It's kind of like the parser is a cop, and you're like, "Hey, man, chill out, right? We're just hanging out here.
Yep,
chill out.
We're just people. You want to smoke? Yeah, I mean, very much like that.
Skateboarding's not a crime, man.
Very much like that.
I like it.
And even if you convince the other people that are necessary to, you know, the IE team, Mozilla, whatever, they may or may not agree that it's a good idea, and they may also be like, that's a good idea later. You know, like,
silent.
Yeah. That's okay.
Crickets.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you sort of have to, if you're doing this kind of work, you really have to resign yourself to the notion that your ability to make change, on the one hand, is gated on a lot of people that you don't know and whose minds you can't change quickly. But on the other hand, it really is up to you. And if you decide not to do anything, then the status quo is that nothing happens. I mean, I don't know about you, but I was pretty dissatisfied with the way the 2000s went for us. I don't think the 2000s were a good example of web browsers showing, you know, positive leadership about how to build a significantly better platform. I don't think we did a great job. Mm-hmm. So
feels better.
I really think that, you know, if we don't take some risks, then nothing changes. You know, the predicate for something getting better is that it has to be different. And nothing gets different unless someone decides to change something.
There's a lot of political analogy there.
It's not an analogy. It's a political process.
No, I mean, just, right.
You know, it's interesting with something like web components. It's like, it's one of those, like, again, politics. It's like communism is good in theory, but, you know, how does it work in the real world? But I think when Polymer Project came around, and I didn't know that it was like a Palm thing.
It wasn't. We were able to hire those folks to Google, and then we were able to start the Polymer Project.
Okay, so it's like Palm graduates came into Google. I mean, that project really kind of that. Was like a complete demonstration of the power of web components. And
yeah, Scott and Steve and Frankie and Yvonne and all the folks who have joined them since have been, you know, they have seen as much of the horror of trying to build really, really compelling user experiences in a browser as pretty much anybody has. You know, like, it's them and Eric Arvidsson are kind of like my heroes in terms of building great frameworks. And so, you know, when we asked them to go build great stuff and see if they could do it with web components, you know, they had a bunch of notes. We had to change a bunch of stuff. But yeah, so now Polymer is a thing. And part of that process was to build a series of polyfills, which now stand alone on their own over webcomponents.org. And you can get just the polyfills and build your own components without any Polymer stuff, just using those polyfills. And they will.
That's an important distinction, I think. Because I think Polymer had a moment there where it was thought of as the web components polyfill, and that's just not really the case anymore. So I hear that anyway, that, you know, the polyfills are different, but then Polymer is this other thing that kind of helps you working with these, with web components.
Yeah, I mean, we it's hard to sort of, when you look closely at any origin event, it's very difficult to disentangle, you know, what you should do from what eventually ends up happening. you know, and we sort of knew that we had to build polyfills to try to make it possible to use web components before other browser vendors actually bit off on them. And frankly, before we had finally implemented all the bits and pieces. So luckily, they're there now. And if you want to use them, you can. And that means that Polymer can function as a nice sugary library on top of web components. And the stuff they're doing in 0.8 is super exciting. And you know, the performance that they're getting and have worked with us to achieve, I think, is really inspiring. You know, as in terms of like implementing material design and getting really nice interactivity out of the web platform.
So, I mean, maybe we could reach into some theoretical future stuff a little bit, but it seems like there's a lot of talk, there's a lot of excitement about web components. It does seem futuristic and cool. And but is it? I kind of wonder if you have a gut feeling that like it's at a crux moment. It feels like to me this. Is it definitely the future of web development? Should people be paying 100% attention to it? I mean, I know that you kind of just think, well, we have to do something. So this is the something. But could things swing another way? Or, you know, excuse me. I don't know.
Sure. I mean, I guess I'd think of it this way. Do you want to stop writing HTML? Because if you want to stop writing HTML and stop working in CSS, you can now, right? There are things like React Canvas that will let you just go write all the JavaScript you want. Or mscripten to compile it down to Canvas and render all the stuff yourself. That's possible. But I want to build components for people and just be able to hand them out and then like be able to take somebody else's component and use it in terms of HTML and actually get some UI for it. I mean, you know, the problem with XSLT UIs and XAML and all this other stuff has been frequently that you can't just sort of take a component and get some UI. Like, it just, the pure XML world sucks because you don't get any styling, you don't get any interactivity, you don't get any behavior. HTML is better than that because when you put a tag on a page, it gives you something. It gives you something for free that you didn't have before, and that's awesome. And so creating a system that lets people build these truly portable components that they can mix and match and share, I hope is going to break open this world of tall per framework stacks, right? We saw this in the, you know, in the previous framework era. We're seeing this today in Angular and Ember and React, where no one can share components, no matter how good anyone's component is. And people are like, well, which one should I choose? And like, well, no, this is the new hotness. And you can't really ever get along. But if your interface is just DOM, and the way you build a component or use a component is just to put a tag in a page, and that's portable everywhere, then I don't know that, like, I don't know that really the framework war is even really salient to how the web components thing is going to play out, because people can build web components and then people can use them. And maybe they don't even know that they're using them, right? And that's great. I think that that's a lot of value. And because these things sort of operate below the level of the current framework wars, I think that's going to be really hopeful for people who want to just build things and share them. And I think we're starting to see integration. Like, I saw a series of talks. Someone cobbled together a list. There have been talks at the recent Ember conference about using Polymer with Ember, the recent React conference about using web components with React, and the recent Angular conference about using Polymer with Angular. Right?
So it supersedes any of that stuff. Those things can live together.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, you know, if you can use HTML, you can use web components. And so why not?
Yeah, yeah. It's hard for me to wrap my head around all this, honestly. You know, like, I feel like I have an understanding of the different components. You know, I've read plenty of talks and all that stuff. But to me, to imagine what the future is like when all this stuff is just really settled in is tough. Like, that, you know, that this idea that you could maybe just, you know, look at a bunch of custom modules that, you know, like, I'm building an app. I'm going to need this one, this one, this one. Now I have an app now. You know, is it going to be like that, or is that going to be... Is that going to be scary? Or how are they going to share, you know, things between those modules such that the app has a cohesive feel and isn't breaking the rules that we think of now? Like, it's not loading three different libraries and it's not loading 20 different style sheets. And like, are those things still going to be problems?
I mean, yeah, they're always going to be problems, right? I mean, we haven't bent physics,
right?
Loading resources is still some expensive. Things are going to change, though, right? Where the trade-offs lie is absolutely going to change in the presence of both service workers and web components. So web components are going to change the series of decisions that you have to make about using a component. I think Jan Milowski, I'm going to I just murdered his last name. You'll forgive me. Has worked on a document that sort of is like the gold standard for web components. And basically, it's be as good as an HTML component. It's awesome. This document is amazing because it basically calls people who are making web components to have them be as high quality and as inert, frankly, as an HTML element is. Like, it should be accessible. It should load quickly. Nice. It shouldn't have a bunch of interactions between other things. It should be relatively self-contained. These are all properties that we like about them. But because we weren't building them for ourselves, you know, we sort of had to call those properties out on a per framework component basis, right? We couldn't share any of that understanding about what it is we wanted because we weren't working in a shared vocabulary. But the other side of it is that service workers are going to change the network economics pretty dramatically for apps at the high end. If you start building an application today, you can start to sort of take a subset or a snippet and render it on the server and send it down. And that's sort of how we build most of our apps most of the time. Or you can choose to build a super tall JavaScript heavy stack and then wait up front, and then boom, there you are. You're in the super interactive land. And then apps like Gmail and, you know, to some extent, things like Plus or frameworks like React and Ember wind up having to straddle this world where now they look at, like, well, what does server-side rendering mean for us? Can we do that? You could imagine that what you could do is you could do server-side rendering as a bootstrap. And then if you can install the service worker in the background and it can download its resources silently in the background, and eventually the next time you navigate to a page that does that, you can serve that fully dynamic experience. That can change your application model pretty dramatically. I think that's going to change the set. You know, our willingness and ability to contemplate larger amounts of JavaScript on the client.
Mm-hmm. That's a, you know, we had Tom Dale on the other day, and he was largely in agreement with that sentiment. You know, it turns out you should have a server-side app that can do stuff, and then you can make it better on the front. I gave a little talk. This is a very minor addition to put to that, but I had I did a little talk about SVG. I've been doing a bunch of stuff with SVG, and I gave a talk today on it, and I made a little analogy about the day that the period in which the SVG was born, which was the, you know, very late, you know, 1999-ish, that it was born in this land of bandwidth sucking. You know, essentially, why should we transmit pixel data over modems when we could send math instead and geometry and let the powerful computer sitting in front of you do the job of drawing it, which was kind of
And then they added XML.
Right. It's surely there's some danger in there, but the idea is that that sentiment is happening again. Like, let's let the computer in front of us do the hard work and send, because all these years later, bandwidth is still the bottleneck.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the ability to have apps that you use more frequently having a more persistent presence on your device, it absolutely makes sense. You know, I've got a computer in my pocket that's got more cores and, you know, faster clock rate and more memory than anything I used up until, you know, 2004, you know, and I was like home building, you know, dual core boxes, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't like I was begging for bandwidth or internal bandwidth or CPU. So absolutely, I think, you know, being able to take better advantage of the local device is going to set application platforms apart, and I want the web to be able to play there, right? You know, we're doing an enormous amount of work today on the Chrome team to make sure that more of what you want to do when you build a web app happens on the GPU, and more of your stuff is taking better advantage of those local resources. You know, things like service workers and a bunch of the proposals that are happening now in the CSS working group, in something that's sort of a joint effort between the TAG, which I'm on, and the CSS working group, which a lot of other people are on, called Houdini, is trying to break open these other threads that are already there in the computer, that are already there in the renderer, that you don't have any ability to script today. Like web audio is even looking at creating an audio worker type so that you can run script on the audio thread. You know, like, these are really powerful things. These are things that are going to maybe let us do significantly better in terms of interactivity and experience on the client. And they don't have any server-side analog.
That's cool stuff. Wow. I'm going to do another sponsor here. The website I want to send you to is speedcurve.com. And this is so legitimately cool. For, number one, have you heard of web page test? I think everybody has, unless you've been kind of under a rock. It is the tool for testing web page performance, front end web page performance, right? It's super powerful. There's a million features on it. You know, type in your web address and just see what you get. You know, you get this film strip view of the website loading, and you get, you know, you can do it from different browsers. And you get the network waterfall, and there's just so many cool features that are a part of it. It also has this open API. Another kind of fact about web page test, and all apologies to the web page test team, it's kind of gnarly. It's kind of gnarly looking. And you just get the one test, you know, like you run it and you get the data and cool. But it has this open API. So people are building products on top of it. SpeedCurve is one of those products where it kind of uses the web page test API, but it makes this like crazy beautiful dashboards and stuff to go with it. But it's kind of more than that. You sign up, you have this account, and it tracks the data over time. So you get these, you know, it's kind of automatically doing this for you over time and charting what you get. So it's a way to stay on top of web performance over time. And you can, when you log in with your account, you have you heard of performance budgets? You know, it's kind of like, I want this many resources, you know, this much time for the server to respond, you know, this many seconds for the page to load, all those type of things. You say, these are the things that are important to me. I want an alert. I want a webhook hit when we break go over this performance budget. If we say we only want 20 requests and we have 21 requests on a page, hit our Slack with a thing that says, you broke your performance budget. SpeedCurve will do that for you. It's super cool. So everybody, you know, you talk about performance budgets, you talk about caring about performance. This is a tool that you can sign up for, and it will be your watchdog for it. You not only put in your own site, but you put in competitors' sites too, people that you want to stay ahead of. And all that information is also, it's like battling you against them. So it kind of is like gamifying your performance a little bit, which is pretty, pretty sweet, I think. They have an API as well for their stuff, for you to pulling in data so you can develop on it, which is great. They have this huge redesign coming out. So this is going to release to the podcast on Monday. By the end of the week that this is coming out, they're releasing all this new stuff, all kinds of cool stuff. One of them is responsive breakpoints, which is, it's not only going to test your site, you know, like from this AWS location and, you know, in this particular browser, but you can have it do it at your different breakpoints that you set. So you can test your mobile site, you can test your tablet sized site, you know, you can give it the breakpoints you want to test at, and it will test against those. So if you want to specifically watch certain breakpoints, performance is pretty cool. And I was even talking to Mark, the SpeedCurve guy today, and he said, we have a big new hire that we're going to announce at the end of the week, and he wouldn't tell me who it is. So they're hiring some high profile performance person to join the SpeedCurve team, and that's going to be looking out next week, and he wouldn't tell me. So you're just going to have to go sign up. They have a free trial of SpeedCurve. You can sign up for that, and you'll get the email when all this stuff breaks. But this is the site for staying on top of your web performance. All right, let's do some more, shall we? Maybe we should do a few Q&As while we have a little time.
Let's do it. This one is actually about service workers, so I think it's in the wheelhouse. Brent K calls in. He wrote in. He did not drive it. My question is about offline first, quote unquote, and the proposed service workers, quote unquote, API. I've seen a lot of chatter online about how we might eventually get service workers or some other API that would allow web apps to be truly offline first. Do you think this will happen, or do you think this will have an impact in making web apps more competitive with native apps? When might we actually get this? I've heard a lot of bad things about HTML5's stab at this, the infamous app cache is a douchebag article, and if I want to implement offline first in my web apps, should I wait for service workers, or should I start learning the app cache stuff now?
All you, Alex.
Okay, so I'll try to take those pieces one at a time, but my memory is quite poor, so you'll have to remind me which ones I've forgotten as I go.
Okay, we got offline first.
Can you use service workers to be offline, to make an offline first app?
Yes, and you can do it today. We shipped service workers to Stable in Chrome 40, which was something like 8 weeks ago, maybe 6 weeks ago. I can't remember. But basically, you know, just after the Christmas break, we came back and we're like, boom, service workers, here you go. And as of yesterday, with with the WebView update to Android that's going to be going out soon, which is based on Chrome 40 as well. You can actually build web content this way that'll work in pretty much every context that you would be running web content. And that means that you can build offline first today. We've been working for years now with Mozilla and a bunch of other, you know, super engaged contributors from across the community, folks at Twitter, folks. So many I can't name them all. Please go look at the Service Worker GitHub repo if you want a quick slice of, you know, the massive size of the community investment that's gone into this. Mozilla is actively working on it. They're looking to ship sometime soon. They've had it in a branch. They're moving it off the branch down into their primary development trunk. And that means that they're on a path to ship, which is exciting. And they've been active participants with us. Yonah Van Kesteren has been deeply engaged with Jake Archibald and I and Yongki Song from Samsung in specifying and dealing with all the details of this spec. And so this is really happening, and it's really happening right now. And the other side of it is that, you know, we don't really like App Cache. We don't like our implementation of App Cache. We're probably going to rip it out of the product at some point. as soon as usage falls far enough that we can justify it to ourselves.
It's gone.
Oh, yeah.
It's on the cutting track or whatever.
It's not gone, but we are eyeing it up for dinner.
That is a rare moment, isn't it? That doesn't happen very often.
Actually, no. This is super cool. When we changed a bunch of stuff about how the Blink project runs, and when it started to become the Blink project, we added what we call use counters. Chrome's always had a very active histogram system for letting us sort of watch anonymous or statistics that are reported by users who opt into anonymous statistics reporting. But now we can sort of look at the whole web and instrument Chrome and say, what percentage of page loads are using a particular feature? It's actually part of our feature dashboard, and you can go look at them too. And it's
really
great, because once they fall below a particular threshold, you'll see if you search Blink Dev, which is our primary mailing list for intent to deprecate and remove, what you'll see are a flurry of proposals to remove crappy stuff out of the web platform. And it's happening right now. It's happening all around you. You just hopefully aren't noticing.
Yeah, right, because it would suck if you noticed, right? Because I have a website out there that's using one of these features that's broke now all of a sudden.
Yeah, the big one that's really the big one that has been very contentious recently is something called show modal dialogue, where we tried and then tried again and then tried again and again to do it. And I think we finally talked to everybody who's got like a broke old school version of Outlook Web Access or something behind the firewall into, you know, upgrading or something, so we can actually do it. But, you know, we are removing junk out of the cruft out of the platform as it falls into disuse. But we needed the data to do it. Now that we're getting data, we're able to move faster.
Yeah. In our world, go ahead. You go, Dave.
Oh, why are you getting rid of H4, H5, and H6? I'm just kidding. But nobody uses those.
The one was... Oh.
So it's just me? I'm the only... Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, no one's... They're out.
Vendor prefixes is always an interesting one, right? Like, do you chop those or do you just leave them forever?
Those are a place where we are actively looking at data and trying to chop them. Like, we have it as stated intent to get rid of as many as we can, so we're working on it.
Cool.
What is the URL for that? Isn't there some public way to see this, or is this private?
One moment.
I think we can do one more question before we kill it too, which I think will tie into this a little bit.
There it is. If you go to chromestatus.com/metrics/feature/popularity, let me paste it into the chat here. There you go. You can sort of see how many web pages are using what.
That's so awesome. CSS.
Not everything's instrumented, so if there's something that you're specifically itching for us to get rid of, let us know and we'll add a use counter.
Turns out width.
Or file a bug.
Width is going to stick around for a while.
Yeah.
Oh my God! Text.
Oh, man, I went to the bottom.
Oh, this
canvas
is so
rendering
fascinating.
Context 2D set alpha. I think that this week.
I could spend all day in here.
Not everything that's there is on the chopping block, right? Service workers are new, and so even though they're not going to use a ton, we're not going to kill them. Basically, there's just a bunch of stuff where, especially the things like prefixes, where they cause problems, and so we're trying to get rid of things that are problematic. But we didn't have any insight before, and now we do.
But like 0.0001 is like. I don't know. That's like NASA would call that a zero.
Yeah, I mean, our current, I think community agreed cutoff is 0.03%.
Oh, that's, you know, that's not, that's fairly high still, which is cool. There's, yeah, there's definitely new stuff in here too. You know, I'm looking at like text underline style and stuff. That's like, oh, I just read about that today. About
no, these are not, this is not a kill list. No.
I know that. It's a usage list. Yeah. I'm just, yeah. It's fun to look through because it's either possibly going to go on the kill list or it's super new and it's like worth looking at anyway because new is fun. Let's see. This is one. This might be a weird way to end it, but we're going to do it anyway. Mark D writes in, I was wondering if, considering the native features of browser, if the native features of browser stay extending, getting more powerful, does jQuery UI still make sense? Do you suggest using it or avoid it? And he asks about jQuery mobile too. So Mark D's, you know, I don't know if this is confusing things or whatever, but the reason I put this in here is because it's kind of like jQuery UI provides literally UI. It, you know, like you mentioned that one of those, you know, show modal dialogue or whatever. Do browsers ever, do you see them getting into providing, like, in some sense, they do provide UI, right? You say a button and an HTML element, and it looks like a button. There's UI for a button there. It has states. You can click it, and it looks like it's being clicked and stuff. But it doesn't generally get into, like, a slider or a, you know, even in things like input type date and stuff, it's not really specified how that should work and how that should look. Like, how do you, I'm interested in where browsers kind of draw the line at dealing with UI.
Yeah, this is an area that we do very poorly in right now. I don't think anyone can deny that. If you look at the sort of the vocabulary of HTML elements, it hasn't really expanded in a meaningful way in terms of providing new UI in a long time. In fact, I think a lot of the HTML5 elements that are quote-unquote semantic are pretty much bullshit because they don't give you any UI, right? They didn't give you anything in return for saying section or article. And by the way, which one am I supposed to use? Maybe you guys know. Can I get like a short course on that? Because I would love to know.
Well, you see, articles are something that could be an RSS post. I know, you're just kidding, kind of, but go on.
Sections have an HR after them.
Doing it all wrong. Okay. One of the things that we've done a poor job of from a browser and standards perspective is to try to use data about what people actually want to do to go inform the set of things that we should go do. Yeah, someone just said in the chat, div all the things. And that's what we're currently doing. Like, if you look at every single UI framework that we build today, that's basically what it's doing. And then it's trying to reconstruct the semantics of what it meant on top of that. And it usually exposes that only to script. So this is a bad thing. And one of my hopes for web components is that people can take that stuff that they're currently doing in script where they div all the things, hide all those divs away inside of a shadow DOM, and then expose the semantic of what they actually meant it to be out through the tag and through the interface of the element name and the attributes so that we can use things like the web crawler to go look at the world and go, what are people actually using? Like, which of these things actually deserve for us to go into a room and figure out in a standardized way so that we could bake a good version of it into the browser so that you didn't have to pay as much to load it off the wire or have some maybe potentially dodgy accessibility story about it or something, right? And all of that, I think, is part of the genesis of the Extensible Web Manifesto, which I'll put a quick plug in for. It's sort of something that fell out of our experience trying to build web components and a bunch of the other things that came around it where, you know, Yehuda Katz and a bunch of the folks who were involved in the tag and I sort of tried to distill this experience into a notion of what should we provide in the browser with a view towards saying that there's a bunch of stuff in the browser that's like words in a dictionary, right? And words in a dictionary didn't show up because someone decided to invent them in the dictionary. That's not how language evolves. Instead, there was slang, and then slang got popular, and then slang became, you know, common culture. And then once it's common culture, it deserves a place in the dictionary. And today, the way we build standards is to go guess about what people might want in the dictionary at some point in the future without ever consulting the real world. This is terrible. This is bullshit. We should do significantly better, and we should use data to understand that world. And so web components and things like it can help give us a better way of telling the world we're using this slang and it's really meaningful and therefore you should put it in a dictionary. So I think that's how we could evolve to a world where we put more UI and more semantic elements into the browser for things that actually have meaning to end users and to developers. Because if you just satisfy one of those two constituencies, you haven't done very well, right? Like a developer isn't trying to say like, well, I have a semantic thing here and it's clearly an event. But I wanted to, you know, tell nobody at all about where it is or when it is, except a crawler, right? Nobody ever does that. Instead, they build a component, they put a map in there, and then they have some time stuff, and then they mark it up with all this extra stuff to tell a third party about it, which sucks, right? Using microformats at schema.org means that you have to repeat yourself. You can't say what you mean and say it once. You have to go keep saying it to lots of other people. So my goal, specifically with all this stuff, is to try to get to a place where we can, you know, build an evolving and learning ecosystem as opposed to one that's guessing and failing.
I always thought that was the story behind HTML5, is like, we looked at what authors were doing with class names and then took...
Look, if you look at that story, it doesn't go any deeper. It's, I queried the web, and what I got at the other side of it was a list of class names.
Right.
I didn't really understand what if there was any common semantic behind them, but these words keep coming up. So what I'm going to do is put those words as tag names in there and let you decide what they should mean. Mm-hmm. who's that for? Why is that good?
Sure. I think that, you know, the minor thing that we got out of it was that they map, some of them map to ARIA roles. That's kind of good. But, you know, I see where you're going.
Yeah, but ARIA roles are sort of similar, right? Why aren't there ARIA roles that map all of HTML? Why aren't there ARIA roles in states that map entirely? Like, you know, there's just this weird set of sort of overlapping, but not, you know, schema.org has one set, microformats have another, ARIA roles and states have another, and maybe those are very disjoint, but then there's HTML, and it seems to express some of these or something in all of those directions, and how do I do it? And then I have to use CSS to configure stuff visually for people and JavaScript to add behavior, right? But what I meant was button.
Yeah, right. So in a perfect world, button really, it means all the right stuff to all the right things.
Yeah, and that's the debate we should be having inside of standards. Not, maybe people want an article. I don't know what an article is, but maybe they want it.
Fair enough. That's a great way to end it, I think. I should say, Dave, do you want to do the typical wrap-up stuff and ask Alex
totally
the one last?
Alex, thank you so much for taking time out of your day. If people are not following you and giving you money, how can they do that? And then what's the one thing you'd like to plug before you go?
Well, you shouldn't give me money. You should give some awesome community project money. I was astonished the other day that I was not already giving money to Remy Sharp's project, JS Bin. So I did that yesterday. So you should too, maybe. Or find another deserving thing or an open source group. But I work for Google, so please don't send me anything. I am slightly late on Twitter because I am slightly late to everything, including Twitter. And what was the last question?
What's the one thing you'd like to plug? What if
the extensible web manifesto you already plugged, but if you want that to be your pick.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's my plug. That's my plug. Okay. Ask for a better rate of progress. Don't ask for a specific feature.
Love it. And it, we should also show that the show, we have a job board at the Shop Talk show. And Dave, you know, just in the confidence of me and Dave chatting, we're talking about one of Dave's favorite parts about this is that it really, you know, these kind of things are actually good for people. They actually find people industry jobs and you know, allow for people's upward mobility in their world should they want it. So we have a job board at Shop Talk Show, shoptalkshow.com/jobs. And we have a recently posted job where they sent in an audio thing. So maybe we could just end the show with that.
Yeah, we totally can.
It's actually a pretty cool job.
Yeah, it's a nice little company.
Hello, Chris. Hello, Dave. Hello, Shop Talk Show. My name's Stephen Garrity. I'm with a small web development company in Eastern Canada called Silver Orange. And we're looking for a front-end web developer to hire, possibly remote. And there's a job posting in the Shop Talk Show job boards. And if you guys know anyone who you think might be suitable, please point them to the job posting or let me know. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. I enjoy the show.
There you go.
They did. So, Daniel Burko was one of the founders of Silver Orange back in the day, and they've done a ton of awesome work. So that would be a pretty rad. But you know, I have a feeling they're trying to hire somebody to work with some of their existingly awesome clients. So probably a pretty good opportunity. It's remote as well. So
there you go. All right. Well, good luck. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Rate it up a 5 with 5 stars. Share with your friends. That's how people find out about the podcast. We really appreciate it. And, yeah, get a new job this week if you hate yours. Chris, you got it?
ChopDocShow.com.
Oh.